I'd like for you to join me in 1 Kings chapter number 10, where we're going to take up the story of King Solomon's wealth in verse 23 in a moment. The parallel for our purposes is over in 2 Chronicles chapter 9, starting at verse 22. So we know that Solomon has been king since the time that David made him king, 24 years at least. It's 20 years since he started work on the temple, which started once his father David died and he became the solo king. He finishes his temple and palace complex. The city of Jerusalem has doubled in size at least since the time of his father David. And it is absolutely chock-a-block with wealth. Shocking wealth. And Solomon is very wise, and he is governing over a great empire. And word gets out about all of this, and the Queen of Sheba, down at the south end of the Arabian Peninsula, hears about this. She thinks that it's an exaggeration and comes to visit him. And she has to acknowledge when everything is done, well, she's breathless to begin with, but then she acknowledges, I didn't even know half the story. It is twice at least what I was told. And this gives you a sense of how significant the empire of King Solomon was. He reigns specifically from the Red Sea area, the Gulf of Aqaba arm of the Red Sea, all the way north to the bend in the Euphrates River, from the Mediterranean shoreline across to the empty quarter, the deep desert of what is modern-day Saudi Arabia. All of that is under his control. And he is making treaties and having relationships with all of the countries that radiate outward from that core empire. And so we are told in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 23, thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. So he is at the top of all kingdoms at this time. The whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his mind. So everybody now sends envoys to Solomon to see if he can unravel some of their puzzles of life. And apparently there's some betting that goes on for some of these, and Solomon always wins the bet. Verse 25, every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses and mules, so much year by year. So he is constantly having visitors show up at Jerusalem, and they are not coming empty-handed. They are bringing all this wealth that's just being added to the wealth that already exists there. Remember, in 1 year, certainly a peak year, he had 666 talents of gold brought in. And that, on the value of today's gold, that's $4 billion worth of value in a single year brought in. Verse 26 of 1 Kings 10. Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. So he was not supposed to be doing this, but he is. And this becomes part of his downfall, I think. In the second half of his kingdom, Solomon begins to start believing his own press reports, that there is nobody better than him. And he will go farther away from God. And we'll talk about how that happened when we get closer to the end of his kingdom. But he's not supposed to be doing horses and chariots, but he is anyway. We have varying numbers between 1 Kings and Chronicles. Remember that in hand copying things, numbers and proper names are the two most difficult things to do properly. And so this is what we read in 1 Kings, that he had 1,400 chariots. In the Chronicles, it says he had 4,000 stalls for horses and chariots. So how do you take those two numbers together? Is it that the chariots had multiple horses on them? Probably. And therefore, he had to have all these stalls for the horses that went with the chariots. The other number is matched between the two, that he had 12,000 horsemen. Now, so these are riders without the chariots. They're even faster than the chariots to get from point A to point B. And we're told that he stationed them in chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. So he has a home guard of chariots and horsemen. In fact, we'll find out that one of the gates of this new extension of the city of Jerusalem is called the Horse Gate. It's over on what today we would refer to as the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. It's mentioned when Nehemiah was rebuilding the walls. Probably that's where the horse guard and the chariot guard were stationed, just to the east of the palace complex, because that's where it would have been. It says that next verse. By the way, I almost forgot. He also has chariot cities and horse cities elsewhere in his kingdom. We had some of them mentioned already. Megiddo, up off of the Valley of Jezreel. The city of Hazor, just off of the flatland that's around the Hula wetlands. This is north of the Sea of Galilee. So these are major areas that chariots could operate in to keep his country protected from any potential problems. One of the things we will discover is that as he becomes more and more self-centered and more tyrannical, that people start chafing against that and rising up against it, and he becomes more aggressive toward them, becomes more tyrannical. And so this is one of the things that we have that happens in history. It gets repeated over and over again, is when a king or a leader starts crossing lines that the people don't like, and they start rising up against that, the king usually starts reinforcing military forces around himself. That's the way it works. Verse 27. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. So silver kind of lost its intrinsic value because there was just so much of it around. He made cedar, that's the wood cedar that's coming out of Lebanon to build a lot of these buildings, as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. Now the Shephelah is the transition area between the hill country of Judah and Samaria down to the flatlands along the Mediterranean coast. And so there were a lot of these sycamore fig trees that could be used for lumber. But there's so much cedar that why would you want to make something from sycamore? if you got fine-grained cedar to use instead. Verse 28, Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt. We know exactly where Egypt's at. It's off to the south and west from Israel, from the Israeli Empire. So they're a very close neighbor. And then Kui. Now, Kui is probably the very, very ancient name for Cilicia. Now, I know a lot of people say Cilicia, but Cilicia was its proper pronounced name in the first century. And so that's very close to the Kui name that we see here. Cilicia is the northeast corner of the Mediterranean basin. It's where Saul, the apostle Paul, comes from. He grew up in Tarsus, the capital city of the region. And so, guess what? That's a northwest neighbor of the Israeli Empire. And so he's getting his horses from two of his close neighbors. The king's traders received them from Kui at a price. And they negotiated a price, basically. Verse 29, a chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver. Now, shekels at this time were weight. They used balance scales in order to decide how much silver needed to pay for certain things. Eventually, the amount of silver that was called a shekel by weight was turned into a coin. That's going to be quite a few centuries after this. But that coin called a shekel was basically 2 days' wages. So it kind of helps us understand the value that we're talking about here. So this, each chariot was worth about 1,200 days' wages. So 4 years, 4 years of wages. Because wages vary in our society day by day, let's put the value of each one of these chariots at roughly $200,000 to $320,000. So these are high-performance vehicles, weapons platforms that he's buying. And then they have to be powered, right? So a horse they could import from Egypt and from Kui for about 150 shekels. So that's 300 days' wages, a year's worth of wages, so somewhere between $50,000 and $80,000 in our current economy. So a high-performance animal to help power these weapons platforms. So these are top-notch chariots and chariot horses. And more than likely, each chariot was powered by more than one horse. So these are very valuable. And so through the king's traders, they were exported to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. And this is where we find out that not only does Solomon buy these chariots and horse chariots for himself, he turns around and becomes a dealer of them. He sells them to other neighbors that may not be able to buy them directly from Egypt or buy them directly from Kui. So he becomes a bit of a weapons merchant as well. And that is pretty much the way that we read the kingdom of Solomon looking somewhere in the 20 years or so on the throne. There is a little bit more I think we could read at this point. from 1 Kings chapter 4. I think we might have done this once before, but I think we can do it again with a little bit of assistance. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 20 says, Judah and Israel were as many as the sand of the sea. Now, that was prophetically fulfilling the promise to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob that they would be blessed as a people group, and you wouldn't want to try to count them. So they are very populous. They ate and drank, and they were happy. Yeah, well, there's not any war going on, and there is a lot of money flowing through this empire. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates, that's that bend in the Euphrates River that I keep talking about, to the land of the Philistines, that's down toward Egypt. We all know where the Gaza Strip is today. That's kind of what we mean by that. And to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. So again, he's got a lot of stuff going in. Solomon's provisions for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. That's how much food was served in the palace kitchen, well, from the palace kitchen into the restaurant area, the dining facility, probably the house of the Forest of Lebanon, on a daily basis. We're talking about food for hundreds of people at one sitting. You've got a lot of chefs that are involved in this. That gives you a sense as to how many people are coming to see King Solomon on a regular basis. For he had dominion over all the region west of the Euphrates, from Tifsa to Gaza, over all the kings west of the Euphrates. He had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba. Now that's the core of the Promised Land. That is ethnic Israeli homeland that we're talking about. So everybody is at peace. Everybody's living safely. We are told every man was under his vine and under his fig tree all the days of Solomon. So everybody was at peace. Everybody was happy. No problems in the world. And so that would continue for the next few years until Solomon's pride, Solomon's dependence upon his own military and on his own politically arranged marriages got the best of him. And we'll come and we'll talk about that later. But before we do that, we need to bring some culture of the period into our story. And for this, we're going to introduce the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, that's part of the wisdom literature in our Bibles. Now, a lot of people want to make this about Solomon getting married. I don't think that's what it is. Others want to make this into some sort of analogy or metaphor for the relationship between Israel and God, or in the New Testament period, between the church and Jesus. And I don't think that's what this is about either. I'm sorry for those of you that want to see it in that spiritualized form. I don't agree with that. I actually think that this is an opera, an Israeli opera dedicated to King Solomon, that portrays the love story of two people inside Solomon's kingdom at its peak. That's my belief. I think it's just here for us to celebrate love. And if you think that's not sufficient, then I guess you can allegorize it. Feel free. But I think it's just here to let us celebrate love. Now, that being said, I have to give my warning here that I've not made it for a while. While we were going over some pretty rough stuff that was happening in David's kingdom. This book is definitely PG-13. So if you don't want to have a chat with your younger children about things that go on intimacy-wise between men and women, husbands and wives in particular, then you need to keep them busy elsewhere until we're done with this bit of culture, okay? Now, thankfully, in my estimation, the translators of our version that we're using this time, the English Standard Version, have put little headings in to help us identify the characters in this opera. I think it is intended to be sung by a woman as the main character, the bride or the girl of the piece. She has a partner, a male singer, that is the boyfriend, the husband in the piece. And then there is a chorus. Possibly it is sometimes a chorus of women. Sometimes it's a chorus of men. Maybe it's a chorus of mixed voices. But it is a chorus that sings back to our two main singers. And so the English Standard Version people help us out with that. Okay? The heading on it is called The Song of Songs, which is in Middle Eastern terms, that means the best song of all, which is Solomon's. Now, some people say, well, that's because it's about Solomon. I've already told you, I don't believe that's the case. And I'll explain as we go through why I don't. Others think that Solomon wrote it. Maybe. We know that he did write songs. And so maybe he wrote this opera. But there's also the possibility that the way that this is written in the Hebrew is that it is a song dedicated to King Solomon, meaning that whoever wrote it said, King Solomon, this is in honor of you and all the peace and prosperity that we have in your kingdom. Pick your choice. But now here we go, and you have to engage your imagination to picture this young lady who begins singing in the opening act of our opera. Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 1, or verse 2. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out, and therefore the virgins love you. Draw me after you. Let's run. The king has brought me into his chambers. It is my opinion that the lady who's playing this role in our opera works in the palace of King Solomon. She is in service to him to be at his beck and call to take care of things in the residence. And so she has a boyfriend that she is interested in that also works for King Solomon. He's a shepherd. And so we begin our opera with her thinking about the guy and thinking about how he smells so good when she sees him. And she wants to be with him, even though she has to work. She has to go and work for the king. And then the chorus chimes in. We will exult and rejoice in you. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. And so this is the chorus apparently singing about her boyfriend. Possibly singing about her, but, you know, she's just been talking about how she likes him so much. Then the lady starts to sing again. I am very dark, but lovely. Oh, daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Now, later we'll find out that she's probably from Lower Galilee, that she's probably from the city of Shunem, which is just a little bit south and east from Nazareth, that she is an ethnic Israeli, obviously, but that she's a workaday girl. She was raised in a working family. And she ended up getting really tan skin. And so she's talking to the ladies in the palace that are not tanned because they haven't had to work out in the sun. I'm dark, but I'm still looking good. Verse 6, don't gaze at me because I'm dark, because the sun has looked upon me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me a keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I've not been able to keep. Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon. For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? So this is where we find out the guy is actually a shepherd. And she wants to meet with him, but she doesn't want to have to hang out where all the other shepherds are hanging out, waiting to accidentally run into him. So she wants him to tell her, tell me where you're going to be taking care of your sheep so we can have a rendezvous. I hope you're enjoying this already. Mark your place. We'll get back here next time.